first thing first. My name is Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Corwin, and I am an alcoholic. Well, it took 5 husbands for me to find the right one. Bless his dear heart. He was as helpless and hopeless a man as I have ever seen. When I laid eyes on him first at the hole in the ground in Huntington Park, there was a kind of a funny a start. I had been leading the meeting and was kind of... kind of being a mother hen to anybody that I didn't recognize or anything, and to make sure that they would just love AA and keep coming back and dry up forever. And I saw this guy standing around after the crowd had thinned out, and I went over to him thinking that nobody was paying any attention to him. It didn't seem like to me. And I said, well, my name is Sybil, and what's yours? And he said, Bob Corwin. And I said, well, I live right here in Huntington Park. Where are you from? And he kind of looked down, and he looked sheepish, and he said, Norwalk. And I thought, oh, the poor guy. That's the nut house down there. You know, that's where they put the real psychopathic ones. And I thought, oh, the poor man. You know, this is... And I just chirped and tried to make him feel welcome and did the very best I could, thinking that he was just a nut. And... He was, really, at the time. But he isn't, really. He's smart. Very, very smart. He was too smart to stay sober. Because he was an atheist. And he believed in the stars. He was an astronomer. And still is. And it's a great love of his, being an amateur astronomer, and I shouldn't say amateur astronomer, he is a good one and has the proper equipment for it. But he did not stay sober, but he lived, finally moved to the close to the hole in the ground, walking distance. Like he lived there and I lived over here, and we became actually neighbors. And we would walk along and swing hands and just like I would with any of you guys that I have done so tonight. And it wasn't all kissy-kissy then. You didn't hug and kiss or anything. You shook hands, say, hello, and that was it. That was it. You never got kissed, that's for sure. And he never kissed me, and I never kissed him. And he raised a family, and they built a new house out in Norwalk, where he truly did live, nearby anyway. And his marriage fell apart, and we re-met in this life that I'm talking about now. When he came back, willing to listen and not be too smart. And that's been a long time. He got sober in 1963. And I'll tell you, he's one of the finest members that I know anything about. And he's been through a great deal health-wise. He's had a quadruple bypass and didn't come up here with me because somebody has to watch the home and all of the animals that we collect. We seem to have a thing. When I knew him in the other life, and he was a neighbor, he had cats, and I had dogs. And now that we're married, we have cats and dogs. And only one dog now. But we have five cats. And somebody has to stay home and feed the cats and take care of the property. And there's all kinds of reasons why that we travel separately. He goes and speaks a lot, and I do the same thing. And he's kept me alive and kept me feeling young because he's so charming. He is absolutely charming. And I'm going to read something, get off the subject of my husband, whom I love so dearly, and we'll talk to on the phone tonight. And I want to tell you that I believe in my heart, and I've just thought of this. I didn't think of it in any other place I've ever talked in my whole life. That I believe that this man, a non-alcoholic, was the first original Al-Anon that hadn't even been born. His name is Fulton Owsler. And when I was drunk and went down to my mother-in-law's home in San Diego to visit them lovely people who thought that I was a nice person. I picked up a Liberty magazine, which you young folks never had an opportunity to study or read because it's been defunct for a good number of years. But in that magazine I idly picked up, there was an article called Alcoholics and God. Alcoholics and God. And I read it. And I was afraid that my mother-in-law would catch me reading it, and so I didn't keep the magazine or anything, but I read it. And then later on, and I'll skip clear from that Alcoholics and God, he described Alcoholics Anonymous as it was then, see? I thought about it and wondered what it was. Just because of this man saying what he did about alcoholics. And so when the Saturday Evening Post came along all those years later, they got me in 1941, on the cover, and I was sobering up from the worst trip that I'd ever had on booze, on alcohol. I had wandered around and driven drunk up to San Francisco and turned around and came back and didn't know how to get back over the ridge route, and a hitchhiker wanted to ride, and I asked him if he could drive, and he said yeah, and I said drive me to Los Angeles, and I crawled in the back seat and passed out and went to sleep. And any of you who heard me talk before know that that I was in bad shape. And daylight, he shook me and he said, lady, wake up, we're in Los Angeles, here's where I leave you. And I said, well, okay. And then I thought, what am I going to tell him when I get home this time? What am I going to tell him? I'll take a Turkish bath and get, I've been gone, I'll catch hell anyway, so I'll just take a Turkish bath and think up a good lie, a really good lie this time that'll believe me, really. And I thought, but I can't think now. So I went to the newsstand and I picked up a magazine, and on the cover, I didn't pay any attention to that, but down in the corner it said Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander, and I just could not believe it, that there I was, again, having an opportunity, Alcoholics and God by this man, Fulton Owsler. Now this was a man who was not an alcoholic, but he was writing a charming piece about it. And I thought, I'll look into it, and I did. But then that brings me back to this piece that I want to read to you, which I think had a significance to me from the moment I picked it up, and it might have some for you, because he wrote this, and it's very blurry, and my eyes are shot, but I'll do the best I can. I hope you like it. It is Charming is the Word for Alcoholics by Fulton Owsler, and of course, you know how I felt about the man that first gave me the gleam of a notion that maybe I didn't have to die. Down at the very bottom of the social scale of AA society are the pariahs, the untouchables, and the outcasts, all underprivileged and all known by one excoriating epithet, relatives. I am a relative. I know my place. I'm not complaining. But I hope no one will mind if I venture the plaintive confession that there are times, oh, many times, when I wish I had been an alcoholic. By that I mean that I wish I were an AA. The reason for that is that I consider the AA people the most charming in the world. Such is my considered opinion. As a journalist, it has been my fortune to meet many of the people who are considered charming. I number among my friends stars and lesser lights of stage and cinema. Writers are my daily diet. I know the ladies and gentlemen of both political parties, and I have been entertained in the White House. I have broken bread with kings and ministers and ambassadors, and I say, after that catalog, which could be extended, that I would prefer an evening with my AA friends to any person or group of persons that I have indicated to you. And I ask myself why I consider so charming these alcoholic caterpillars who have found their butterfly wings in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are more reasons than one, but I can name a few. The AA people are what they are, and they were what they were. Because they are sensitive, imaginative, possessed of a sense of humor and awareness of universal truth. They're sensitive, which means that they are hurt easily. And that helped them to become alcoholics. But when they have found their restoration, they're still so sensitive, they're as sensitive as ever, responsive to beauty and to truth, and they're eager about the intangible glories of this life. And that makes them charming companions. They're imaginative, and that helps them to mix them alcoholics. Some of them drank to flog their ambition onto greater efforts, and others quizzled only to black out endurable demons that rose in their imagination. But when they found their restoration, their imagination is responsive to new incantations, and their talk abounds with color and light, and that makes them charming alcoholics, too. And they have such a sense of humor. Why, even in their cups, they've been known to be damnably funny. Often it was being forced to take seriously the little mean things of life that made them seek escape in a bottle. But when they have found their restoration, their sense of humor finds a blessed freedom, and they're able to reach a godlike state where they can laugh at themselves. And that is the very height of self-conquest. I go to the meetings and listen to the laughter. At what are they all laughing? At ghoulish memories over which weaker souls would cringe in useless remorse. And that makes them wonderful people to be with by candlelight. They're possessed of a sense of universal truth. That is often a new thing in their hearts, the fact that this at-one-ment with God's universe had never been awakened in them is sometimes the reason why they drank. The fact that it was at last awakened is almost always the reason why they were restored to the good and simple ways of life. Now stand with them when the meeting is over and listen while they say the Our Father. They have found a power greater than themselves, which they diligently serve, and that gives them a charm that never was elsewhere on land or sea. It makes you know that God Himself is really charming, because the AA people reflect his mercy.
And that man was not a drunk. How did he capture me so with a piece like that? I got goosebumps when I was reading it just now. I mean, he got to me. I don't know whether it got to anybody else here, but it really got to me, and it has been part of my life for ever so long, and it's been Xeroxed and Xeroxed and printed and printed till I could hardly see the thing, but if I didn't have a copy of it, I wouldn't be able to remember some of these things that he said. I'd soon just go away, you know, finally, if you don't. And so there it was, all these little miracles that finally brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous and allowed me to be here with all you charming people. And you are, too. And you certainly are. And allowed me to be with my daughter, who has been sober a long time. A long time, as Bob would say. And Jerry, her husband, he's one, too. And they've got a good number of years. They've got a good number of years. I honest to goodness, you know, I'm ashamed of it, but I think I'm giving them credit for about a year, but they've been sober, oh, 5, 6, or 7 years, something like that. I can't compute like that fellow I was talking to before the meeting. They could add up the numbers into the millions and just do it. We had a by God genius in our midst with the numbers. But Addie and Gary are precious people, and Gary had me talk for them up in Modesto not too long ago. And every chance I get to be with them, I want to be with them, because their five kids are precious to me. And it has been said that maybe two of their kids need help. I heard a rumor that at least two of their kids need help, and they're out there somewhere maybe. One of them is supposed to be here tonight, and I hope and pray that he is. He said he would be. And I took April to a hole in the ground, and she stayed sober a year. And it just didn't work out. She ran away from home, and she was missing, and we thought she was dead. And she finally came back, pretty licked, and calls me up, and she was my firstborn grandchild, and she couldn't say Sybil. So her first words was trying to say Sybil, and she'd say Bebo. Bebo. B-E-B-O. Bebo. Bebo. So Addie calls me Bebo, Gary calls me Bebo, Bob calls me Bebo, and the grandchildren call me Bebo, and whatever number of great-grandchildren I have that can talk will call me Bebo. And sometimes I think that B-E-B-O is my name. And that's not being anonymous either, but I sure love my kids and my grandchildren and my great-grandkids, and I hope those two that I specifically mentioned will find us in time, because it's a killer. But I'll tell you about me. When I picked up that Saturday Evening Post article, if it hadn't happened at that particular time, oh, I would have been dead so many years ago. Because what happened? I didn't get anything right. It was just those people that I had read about twice. Liberty, sort of, and then the Saturday Evening Post. And it just didn't seem possible that a person like me would have enough sense to be able to stay sober. Because things were so different then. I called up, on my last drunk, I called Cliff Walker, and I could talk about him all night. And he was the guy that answered the phone. I called from the bar, and I on account of the article, which I didn't really make it, you know. And Cliff Walker said that I was drunk and to go home and sober up and call him, that he was a milkman and that he couldn't talk to me now, but that he would have someone call me, and he did, and they told me where the meeting was. He said, they meet every Friday night. I've got to get to work. I've got a family to support, and you're drunk. But go down to 2200, go down to Elks Temple. And go on down there, and I can talk to you later when I get a day off or something. But I've got to get to work now, so go down to the Elks Temple on Friday night. So I did. My non-alcoholic husband drove me down there, and I had my hair with the red turban over it to hide it, and I had a nervous twitch, and my lip jerked, and my eyes were bloodshot, and I went down there. And there was this outstanding man who scared the wits out of me. There was a terrible mistake made at that time, and I want to tell you about that. There was a terrible mistake. I heard it. I heard what he said. They had not had any women, and it was all a mistake. I want to assure you in advance that it was. But he was dynamic, and he captured me when he stood up there with a man of authority. And he said, "Now at this juncture, before the regular meeting starts, we'll have to ask all the women to leave." And I thought, oh, I looked that bad that they're announcing that I'm being thrown out, you know. I'm being thrown out. And I got up and I left. And I went out in the lobby and I sobbed and I sobbed. And Dick Maxwell, who's a non-alcoholic and he looked like a senator or something and he'd never had a short beer in his life, he was a man, wasn't he? But there he sat. And I went out there and I cried and I wrung my hands. And the few women that had come down with their husbands were back there on a sofa someplace knitting and talking about their husbands, about Alan. You know, there was no Al-Anon. There was really nothing. And all I'm doing is thinking that this bunch of people in there, that maybe they were spending the entire evening with Dick Maxwell, and that they were doctors. Maybe they were doctors. They would cure me. And maybe the whole thing would turn out, you know. And I fantasized that maybe they would give him a pill to give to his poor sick Sybil. And so when he came out, I said, "Give me my pills and let's go home." I just couldn't. My hands were wet with sweat, and I was just so sick, and I was so shaky. I had it just in my head that they would have some magic potion that would fix me real good for life. And he said, "Sib, you just don't know what I've been through. You just don't know what I..." He says, "They just got up there and bragged and bragged and bragged about their drinking, and they bragged, and they all looked at me, and they droned on and on about their boozing, all the jails and hospitals they'd been in and everything." And he said, I don't know what it was all about. He says, "I'll take you home, all right." So he did, and I just cried and sobbed all the way home. And it was almost a vast mistake. And it's a wonder that I ever did go back. But, of course, you see that I did. And eventually I got to meet Cliff Walker. And when I went back the following week, Cliff Walker had called Frank Randall, the leader. You see, in those days, if you had a group, it was yours. You owned it. There were no traditions. And so Frank and Mark Joseph, who were the first two, and they're in the third edition, I believe, Bob read it to me before I came up here, and I didn't even know that they talked about them. They didn't mention my name, but they sure did talk about Frank coming over from Phoenix, Arizona to get sober, which he did. And he bumped into Mark Joseph, who had just come out from Denver, and they teamed up, and they became the leaders of the group until they got thrown out. And it was just a mess in those days. Nobody knew anything. For instance, we had a guy named Lee Fowler, who could never stay sober. But he would come up here, up to the Friday night meeting, which was growing a little bit. And he'd say, "Look at me, don't I look good?" And everybody said, "Yes, yes, yes." "What about it, Lee?" "Well, I want to tell you about Johnny Miller's Sanitarium. It's right down here at 6th and Bixel, and it's walking distance from this hall." And we had moved from the Elks Temple over to 2200 West 7th Street. And he says, "Look, I was in Johnny Miller's Sanitarium, and it's only $35 a week, board and room, and they'll give you all the pills you want." So... I just thought that sounded okay. And Frank and Mark really did, although this guy, Lee Fowler, I guess, died that way. But what they did, and I want you to know what they did,
They gave us pills to take and to give our babies to so they would snap out of it and be able to come to the meeting. And so I would have my little thing with the pills, you know, and I would give them out. And then one night I went back on a Friday night, and Frank said, hear this. I mean, I want you all to hear this. One of you evidently gave a guy too many of those pills, and he nearly died, and they took him over to the county hospital, and they pumped his stomach. And I think he's going to make it. But we, not knowing any better, we can't dispense this medication where it's needed anymore. It's not up to us to do that. So any of you got any pills left in your pocket, you come up here and turn them in right now. And so we go up and shake our purse. Turned in our medication. And I bet you think I'm just making this all up. But I'm not. I didn't even know that if I took one, it would make me feel good. Because my mother, when she was dying, and I was drunk and crying and not able to, and I knew she was dying, and she died. And I was sitting in the big leather armchair with my jug. And I would go in, and they were giving her, she was a long time dying with her heart, God bless her. And I would go in there, and I'd give her a red one, or a yellow one, or a white one. I'd go by color, and all of that stuff, you know. I didn't know that they could turn me on, or fix me up, or do anything good or bad or indifferent. And there I was, just drinking this booze. Right there, crying, knowing that she's going to die, which she did, and just ignorance, just rank ignorance. Didn't know about the way the world is today, with so much going on and the addictions that people have. One of those ex-husbands of mine couldn't stay sober, but he was a compulsive gambler, and I moved to Reno with him so that he could gamble 24 hours a day. And I sure did that. That's where the Willis part came in. And he's a fine man. And Addie and I met him first at a dance. And she was a teenager, and he was a marvelous dancer. And on the way home, we were chuckling. You remember the old dance on Saturday nights? And you'd go with me. And Jim could dance. Oh, my. He knew all the latest steps. And Addie and I decided which one would get him. And I eventually did. She married somebody else. But Jim Willis was really a good man, a fine man. But he couldn't stay sober. But he sure could spend that money. And with that knowledge that he had about AA, he was able to start Gamblers Anonymous. And then Gamblers Anonymous had a fat lady who asked him how she could lose weight. And he said, well, why don't you start a group for fat ladies and men, and maybe they can take off weight. And so OA came about, and it just keeps going. These spiritual principles that can be applied to the problems of people who need that, you know. And so he made his life okay for millions. I don't know how big those things are, because I don't visit those people. Someone to help Mrs. Stevens, who was taking care of it first, and I had money, didn't mean anything, just made me miserable, and I was working myself to death down there at the arena. There were no freeways, and I was driving back and forth on Tuesdays boxing and Thursdays wrestling, and then when TV came in and I had to go through bankruptcy, it just damn near killed me, and I had to go out and get a job again as a legal secretary, and I've worked at everything, you name it. I was a taxi dancer during the Depression, back in that other life. That's where I met Dick Maxwell. He was just looking around for some gal, and he went down on Skid Row, and he found me. And,
And his folks were so brilliant, and his grandfather was General Barlow in the Army, head of the engineering corps that had to do with the boundary line between Texas and Mexico and the Panama Canal, all those things, all those wonderful family. And they adored Addie. They just adored her. They were wonderful people. But problems come along, money problems, and I took it too hard, I really did. But I'll tell you what really got bad was Dick Maxwell, that man I'm telling you about, that saved my life, came in that taxi dance hall and danced with me, and I got him to buy me beers, and I would weep and cry and tell him I didn't want to be down there, but I got to work here. I've got a little baby, and I got my father and mother. I have to work here. And then he just, he says, well, you poor little thing. During the break at the taxi dance hall, my first night there, he said, if it's money you want, I've got that. And he says, I can take care of your problems for you, honey. He says, let's get married. And I said, oh, sure, yes. Let's do it. And then he was the one that drove me down to that AA meeting, see, and wondered, well, he couldn't figure it out at all. But I want to tell you one thing. He got fed up with AA. There was no Al-Anon at that time. There was by that time, but he wouldn't have gone anyway. And I would come home from the hole in the ground, if I ever get around to telling you about it. And he would be sitting in the rocking chair in the living room, just like I'd come home from a bar. Rocking back and forth. And I would come in, and he'd say, again, meaning another meeting. And I'd go over, and I knelt down by the chair and say, I know I'm going to too many AA meetings, Dick. I know I am. I'm going to too many. But I just can't help it. I've got to go. If I don't go, I'll go back to drinking, and it'll kill us. And he said, well, I tell you this. He says, you are going too much. He says, you're going again and again and again, and you're never here. You can't take care of anything. He says, I have this wonderful idea. And he says, I want to tell you about it. And everything will be all right. I promise you it will be all right. He says, I've been thinking, and I've been sitting here rocking and thinking, and wondering when you'd get home. Now, honey, if you will go back to drinking like you did in the good old days, I'll take care of you. You won't have to worry about a thing. And I began to get goose pimples, and I began to listen, and he was pleading with me to get drunk, and he would take care of me, and everything would be all right. And he was killing me, and he didn't know it, and I got numb. And I don't know. I'm feeling it. It's very painful. He was such a good man. And I had a new car, and I know what I did. I left that 10-room house with 3 baths and 4 bedrooms and the whole thing. I left that, and I didn't look back. Because I walked out in the driveway, and I got in my car, and I left. And I went down to West Adams Boulevard, where there was a millionaire's section at one time, if you were ever familiar with Los Angeles. And I rented a housekeeping room with a gas plate. And Christmas rolled around, and I worked at the Times there at the newspaper, supporting myself again, and taking a streetcar out to the hole in the ground. And because I left the car, I started to take the car, and I thought, no, you had nothing when he found you. And Addie's name was Addie Maxwell. He adored her, and he had adopted her and everything, and I can't take the car. If I'm going to leave, I'll leave in the shape I was in when he found me. That's the only decent thing to do. And so when Christmas rolled around, I walked down to the corner and bought a little fir spruce or something about this, a little bigger than those bouquets, and I put it up on my dresser. And it dried out there, too. But every morning of my life, the church down on the corner of Adams and Figueroa, those church bells would ring, ding, dong, ding, dong, ding, dong. And I'd listen to those church bells. And I was lonely. And I was very lonely. It was hard. It was hard to work and live in a housekeeping room. And I felt sorry for myself. And I'm glad I did what I did, but it wasn't fun. It really wasn't fun. It was rough. It was tough. But I did the right thing. And then finally his family died, and I was a secretary of the central office when finally poor Dick had cancer that they couldn't fix. And there was no one to go see him in the hospital. And I visited him during his last days, and I'm glad I did that. They had to cut his tongue out. All he could do was just write notes to me. And so that was tough, and it was rough. But then, that's the way it is. Everybody has things that happen good, and they happen bad, and then it works for you. Well, you can make some kind of a comeback in your head and stay sober a heartbeat at a time. And it'll work up to a minute. And a minute will work up to an hour. And so on. And you'll be glad you did. I hope if that's all that I can tell you about, there's one more thing I got to do. I promised I'd do this. Let me see if I've got time. One night, my brother Tex was talking to a fellow named Joe. Tex now had a very bum heart, and he couldn't breathe hardly down at the hole in the ground. And this guy had just come back from a drunk, and he came up to Tex. Tex was wheezing. And this guy's name was Joe, and he said, Tex, I've come back. I want to ask you what step that I missed. I must have missed a step. Everybody else has stayed. I guess I left one out and I missed it, and then that's why I keep getting drunk. Can you tell me which step I missed? And Tex said, Joe, I got to get out and get some air. So let's go out and sit on the steps. And I'll try to tell you the best I can. And he got out and got his little shot of oxygen, and he said, now, what we talk about down at the hole in the ground are the steps. He said, they get up and they participate. Depending on how many people are there, we cut it up into a pie so that everybody gets to talk 3 or 4 minutes, so that everybody can talk 3, 4, or 5 minutes. And he says, the first step is the first step. It says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable, and you just have never admitted that you were an alcoholic, and you just don't think your life is unmanageable, and that's about it. And Joe said, thanks, Tex, that's right, you're right. So now I'm ready. That's right, Tex. And that's going to keep me sober. And Tex said, no, sit down, Joe. Joe says, I've got to go home. But Tex said, sit down, I've only just begun. Because the second one said that we came to believe in a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And he says, you people down here that don't believe in some power greater than yourself, you talk about it's a doorknob or it's a bouquet or just all of that stuff. It's not that at all. You just don't. They talked a great deal about doorknobs in those days. I don't know where he got that expression. He said, no, if you would stay sober and try to help somebody else and get your mind off yourself,
you can be restored to sanity, but you think you know it all. You're a know-it-all. And then it says the third one, you will always skip that one because it says something that you don't listen to. It says we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood it. And you just don't listen to all of it because that's what it says, as you understand it. And it doesn't say that you did it at that moment. It says we made a decision to. And that leaves a door open for you to come to meetings until you do believe in something. The big book or your sponsor or something. But you are too stubborn. So you won't do that. You're just too stubborn. Made a decision. And the fourth one just tells you what to do. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And that means that we write it down. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And later on it's going to tell us more about that too, but I'll get to that later. We made a decision, and now you're going to write something down. And if you just write down one thing and do something about it, just write down one thing. If you can't think of anything maybe but fear, write it down. Or jealousy or whatever is in your head, just write one thing down and then do something about it. And just don't make that big a deal out of it and try to capture the whole thing when your brain hasn't cleared up from booze. And it'll work. And then, when you have done that and you have written it down, and you're going to continue to do this, but then, the fifth one, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. And those wrongs were discovered in your inventory, which you didn't take. And so it went on, entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And seven, we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. And in meeting Bill, we ask him why that in one place that he would say defects of character and another place he'd call it something else. And he says, well, I was just a budding young author and I thought I should just shift the words around and it all means the same thing. He really did. Sins, wrongs, or any of that stuff. He was such a beautiful man. I got to see him, and I got to visit him, and I got to kiss him, and I only met Dr. Bob once. And Dr. Bob was a man of very few words, and I went down to the Shrine Auditorium, and I got to hear Dr. Bob. And I'll never forget that short little guy who, Bill talked maybe an hour and a half, and Dr. Bob talked 20 minutes. At the most. And that was an unforgettable experience. And I know I'm dipping in and out of things that happen to me, but I just can't help it. I get wound up, and that's what I do. And so that's the way it was. Some of the things that are unforgettable in my mind. Tex went up to Bedford Hills later on because he came to know Bill, and Bill invited him up to his home in Bedford Hills at Christmas time. And Tex said that Bill, when he saw his bedroom upstairs, that Bill had a string, we're talking about Bill Wilson now, had a string tied to a nail or something in his bedroom, and that it stretched across to something else, and he'd looped it over, and he had his socks washed, it all hanging on that line, which I think describes the most humble man I can remember. Tex said when he went downstairs the next morning that Bill was sitting on the kitchen table eating cornflakes with his legs hanging over the edge and talking and eating his cereal just like any other human being. And it's hard to imagine, you know, our founder being slopping around like that and just being... It really is. What step was I on with Joe? Eight. Fourth? Huh?
Eight.
All right. And make direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Nine. Because we cannot, at the expense of someone else, if it would hurt them, make amends. Some amends we can never make, except when to do so would injure them or others. And sometimes we just have to bear our own load rather than hurt somebody else. And then when we come to 10, step 10, we continued to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Now, I don't know how prompt... I'm not very prompt, really. Continued to take a personal inventory. I haven't taken an inventory in a while, and do you see what I've done to myself? I'm talking too much, and I'm not listening enough. Because that's the way you can get if you just talk and you don't listen and you don't try to share with people. That's just the way it gets. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Well, text said that a prayer and meditation could be just a good thought for the guy or the gal next sitting next to you. He said, you're saying, stay in there, baby. I believe in you. You'll make it. You can make it. He said, that's a prayer. You don't have to put a tag on it. He said, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it. And then having had a spiritual experience, awakening, they changed it. As a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. Yes, we do. And some of them die and they won't listen. But the majority of them do, if they live. If they live, they come back. And some of them die, and they never make it. And those are the facts. That's just the way it is. AA is a wonderful life. There's just no accounting for the miracles that I could go on until 2 o'clock in the morning and tell you what it has meant to me to be privileged to stand up here and know that on May the 20th, and this is the 7th, 6th or 7th or 8th or something like that, of May, that on the 20th, of May, which is not far off, is it? Less than 2 weeks? I'm going to be 80 years old. My God in heaven, I am 80 years old. I will be, and the only thing that is the matter with me is I haven't got sense enough to sit down when I'm supposed to. I get all wound up in AA and it gets better all the time. And if it didn't get better all the time, I'd leave. And then I would drink and then I would die anyway. So at 80, I'm glad I'm alive, I'll tell you. And I'm just going to keep right on a heartbeat at a time, no matter what, because I believe in you, and you're my medicine. And you're keeping me alive, and I hope I can come back here when I'm 98 or 99 and have one more time. God bless you all.